BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
It's exhilarating. It's like driving a car under an avalanche, but you're taunting the avalanche rather than trying to get away from it.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome to The Inquiry on the BBC World Service with me, David Baker. Each week, one question, four expert witnesses, and an answer. May the 21st, 2022. In his first speech as Australia's new Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese is outlining his vision for the nation. In among the promises of economic growth and greater security, there's a pledge that is music to the ears of Australia's Indigenous population.
I begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet. I pay my respect to their elders, past, present and emerging. And on behalf of the Australian Labor Party, I commit to the Uluru Statement from the Heart and Soul.
The proposal to recognise for the first time in Australia's constitution the rights of the country's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples seems to have widespread support. In early polls, more than 60% of Australians are in favour. But 18 months on, in October this year, voters deliver a resounding no. So this week on The Inquiry, we're asking, what went wrong with Australia's Indigenous call for a voice?
Part 1. Australia's original inhabitants.
When British colonists first landed in Australia in 1788, the country was already inhabited by a large number of different Indigenous peoples.
You're looking upon Aboriginal Australia at that time as somewhere between 300 to 500 different language groups connected to their own country. You could look upon it as a massive map of Europe. Well, all of these different tribal groups and language groups dotted right across the country.
Our first witness is John Maynard, Emeritus Professor of Indigenous Education and Research at the University of Newcastle on Australia's east coast, and himself a Worimi Aboriginal man from the Port Stephen region of New South Wales.
It's interesting that people thought, whether it's anthropologists, archaeologists or historians, for a long period of time across the 20th century, they assumed that the Aboriginal population of Australia may have been 200,000, 400,000, up to 700,000. But in the 1980s, the new estimate on that said the Aboriginal population prior to 1788 was over a million people. That raises the question, where did they go? Because by the turn into the 20th century, the Aboriginal population was recorded at something like 70,000.
Australia's Aboriginal peoples suffered not only from violence from the incomers, but from the diseases they brought too. And they were very nearly wiped out entirely.
Only 6 decades after the British arrival in 1788, the Aboriginal population had been decimated nationally across the continent, somewhere between 60 to 90%.
For those who survived, what followed was more than a century and a half of discrimination and exploitation, as white settlers took over more and more of the land and pushed Aboriginal peoples to the margins.
Aboriginal people were largely herded onto worthless areas of land which you couldn't grow anything on, and there was no employment opportunities. It was inadequate housing, clothing, inadequate diet, which has impacted onto Aboriginal health right up to today. Aboriginal kids were removed from their families and placed into institutions. The Aboriginal boys to be trained as farm labourers, the Aboriginal girls to be trained as domestic servants. And that was the kids that were later termed as the stolen generations. For over many, many decades, my own family, you know, one of my cousins was removed and placed into institutions. I mean, most Aboriginal people can look upon members of their families who suffered under this process.
In 2008, Australian Prime Minister Paul Rudd made a formal apology to the country's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, singling out in particular the Stolen Generations. But for John, this year's referendum was an opportunity to go even further than that, to recognise for the first time Australia's original inhabitants in the country's constitution and to give them a voice in government. And he says that would have benefited the country as a whole.
What was offered to wider non-Indigenous Australia? The opportunity to embrace not just the last 230-odd years since the British arrival, but upwards of 65,000 years of Aboriginal connection to the continent. And that was on the table from an Aboriginal perspective to be shared with the rest of the country. I mean, today Aboriginal people are recognised scientifically as carrying the oldest, longest living memory for humankind across that massive time span.
John has a deep heritage of campaigning for Aboriginal rights. His grandfather set up Australia's first Aboriginal political organisation, the Australian Aboriginal Progressive Association, in Sydney in 1924. So how does he feel now after yet another setback in the Indigenous fight to be heard?
I'm just very, very depressed. It's very frustrating that the sense here we are in the 21st century still demanding and fighting for the things that my grandfather put on the table 100 years ago. Nothing has changed.
Part 2. Going to the polls.
This referendum was about changing the Australian Constitution to include the establishment of an advisory body to Parliament that would allow for Indigenous Australians to give their views on laws and policies that would affect Indigenous people.
Our second witness is Tim Sipomasan, political theorist and chief diversity officer at the University of Oxford in the United Kingdom. From 2013 to 2018, he was Australia's Race Discrimination Commissioner. Tim says that the wording of the referendum, which calls for the creation of an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice, draws directly on a set of proposals known as the Uluru Statement from the Heart that came out of a meeting of First Nation representatives in 2017.
The Uluru Statement from the Heart was pitched as an invitation from Indigenous Australians for the rest of the country to join them in righting some of the historic wrongs in Australia and ensuring that the Australian Constitution did recognise or acknowledge Indigenous occupation and ongoing ownership of the land. It may sound remarkable to those outside Australia, but the Constitution for the Commonwealth of Australia is silent on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.
The Statement of the Heart's call for an Aboriginal advisory body to be set up, he says, represented a more pragmatic approach to Indigenous activism.
Previous calls from Indigenous people involved the proposal for an establishment of a non-discrimination clause in the Australian Constitution. This took a very different path in that it was felt by many Indigenous leaders at the time that going for a constitutionally enshrined protection against racial discrimination was too ambitious, and they felt that an advisory body was a more realistic target.
Campaigners knew, he says, that winning a referendum would be a tough challenge. But it was an important goal, not least because it would protect the board from any future attempts to disband it.
If you have a legislated body that provides advice, then the Parliament could always legislate to abolish it. If you have something enshrined in the Constitution, by contrast, the only way that you could then abolish or amend that body would be to go back to a referendum to change the Constitution. Bear in mind here that there have been legislated bodies that have existed in the past. There was, for example, an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Commission, which existed for some years, but that was a body that was abolished by the Howard government shortly after it came to office in the mid-1990s.
In March this year, when the referendum was announced, early opinion polls showed that the proposal had the support of 60% of the population. But that was about to change.
In April, the opposition leader, Peter Dutton, came out and declared that he would oppose constitutional change. And from that point onwards, you saw a much more robust no case being waged in public debate, and you saw that public support for the voice being eroded very steadily to a point where it struggled to break 40 by the time that the referendum came around.
In addition, he says, the Yes campaign had perhaps too optimistic a view of human nature when it came to the Australian electorate.
Yes campaigners seemed to assume that the better angels of Australians' nature would prevail, that Australians would agree, that a voice was an intrinsically good idea because it was put forward by Indigenous leaders and Indigenous communities. The problem with that is that Australia is a country where Indigenous people only make up 4% of the population, and there is a significant number of Australians who simply do not know anyone who is Indigenous. So they won't have an Indigenous friend or colleague or neighbour. So understanding the significance of the voice and what an advisory body would do for Indigenous people was something that many people just simply could not grasp.
And indeed, when the results came in, it was clear that Australians had opted for the status quo. To pass, referenda in the country need to win the support of both a majority of residents in at least four of Australia's six states and a majority of the country's population as a whole. The Yes campaign achieved neither of these, with four states and 60% of the population voting against.
The mountains have some energy. When you go there, this energy goes inside you.
Amazing sports stories. Global tales that you may never have heard of, but probably won't forget.
Runners have seen everything, from a family of abominable snowmen to a massive slug, or feeling like being on the edge of a cliff.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Part 3. The two campaigns.
So why did support for the Yes campaign fall away? Our third witness is Andrea Carson, Professor of Political Communication at La Trobe University in Melbourne. She says one problem was the number of different messages coming out of the Yes campaign.
We had two major Yes camps, and how much they talked to each other and coordinated their messages remains to be seen. It would appear that they had quite different messages at various times. And then on the No side, it was a little more coordinated and they had a much more disciplined message.
And in contrast to the Yes campaign, the No campaign's message was straightforward, that a Yes vote would divide the nation, giving First Nations people greater rights than other Australians. And that if you weren't sure what to think, you should just vote against the proposal. Something that it encapsulated in the slogan, if you don't know, say no.
At one point, only a month out from the referendum, I counted 33 different messages coming from the Yes camp. And comparing that to the No camp, they had six messages, but most of their messages were around those two narratives.
And, Andrea says, an additional issue was that much of the campaign was waged on social media, something the No campaign was simply better at.
The No campaign was very good at identifying the different needs of each of the platforms and tailoring their messages accordingly. The Yes campaign was not quite as astute at doing that in the early stages and had fairly blanket messages for each of them, which meant that it wasn't captivating audiences' attention in the way the No was. And the way that we saw that was the No camp was getting over a million views on some of its TikToks and some of its posts on Facebook. So to give you an example, on TikTok, they did three things that really stood out. They used authentic voices by having Indigenous voices speak to the ads. They used humour and they used personal narrative to tell the story rather than taking news clips and parts of speeches, which is what the Yes camp did.
And in amongst all of that, there was a lot of mis and disinformation.
The way that we saw that was in three distinct ways. The first one was to try and reset the agenda. So we saw, particularly from the no side, that there was disinformation about what the actual referendum was about. The more ludicrous example was that it was a UN conspiracy theory to get more land. That once the referendum was passed, the United Nations would be able to make a claim on Australia and that no one would have private property ownership. The other type was attacking the election process, things such as a rigged election and it was stolen and that the process can't be trusted. And then the final type of disinformation we saw was direct attacks on the Australian Electoral Commission. And this was particularly troubling. In Australia, we have a centralised authority, a neutral authority that administers the election that's independent. They have a fine reputation, a very trusted public institution. And to attack that institution and to say that they were part of the conspiracy theory to ensure a yes would win is a really worrying problem for anyone who cares about democracy.
And it may also be the case, she says, that the Yes campaign overestimated how important Aboriginal people's rights were to many Australians.
You only have to go to regional and remote Australia to see that there's some very different attitudes. And they may not necessarily be racist, but they're not front of mind issues. Australia is still very much a materialist country. And by that, I mean that people, their first order problems that they're thinking about and responding to are economic matters, having enough money on the table to be able to pay the bills. And they're not thinking about higher order issues such as human rights and equality. Whereas those that have been able to achieve some of the basic living standards are thinking more about a different type of society. And I think that's where the Yes campaign was.
And finally, there was the fact that some prominent Indigenous politicians came out in support of the No campaign. These included Jacinta Price, a Conservative, who argued on principle against singling out any group of people for special treatment in the Constitution. And on the other side of the political spectrum, Lydia Thorpe, a progressive campaigner who argued that the referendum was a distraction from what she saw as the more important demands of the Uluru Statement from the Heart.
Lydia Thorpe, who was a Greens senator who stood down from the Greens during the lead-up to the campaign over this very issue and is now on the crossbench, was a very vocal voice that the referendum was window dressing and that what was needed was truth-telling and treaty before you had a voice.
Part 4. Where now for Australia's Indigenous peoples?
It was like just a painful, aching emptiness in my chest. It was a slap in the face.
Our fourth witness is Thomas Mayo, an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander man who was at that big meeting of Indigenous leaders in Uluru in 2017. He says the statement from the heart came from a place of optimism about Australians' desire for reconciliation.
We reached a consensus amongst us to suspend our disbelief that Australians would embrace our culture and our offer to be included and to listen to us, and reach that consensus that we would invite Australians to do that.
The referendum has left him heartbroken, he says. Not only because the country rejected the idea of an Aboriginal voice, but also because of the vitriol that emerged during the campaign.
I'm not naive. I understand that politics can be a bit of rough and tumble, but I was surprised at just the intensity of it, the quantity of it. It was unprecedented, I think, in this country. I was on the receiving end. When you start to see pictures of your parents in these memes and things like that, it really does become something that was quite harmful. It affected the mental health, especially throughout the campaign, of Indigenous people. It really made it hard for people, especially that aren't used to confrontation, to join the campaign and do something that they thought was really hopeful, because it just got so ugly.
Thomas acknowledges that the Yes campaign's messages were sometimes confusing.
I don't disagree that that was one of the issues, but you need to understand the context of that or why that came to be. We were fighting on so many fronts, but I think the ultimate destruction of the opportunity came with the opposition party deciding to go against it. No referendum has ever won in this country without bipartisan support, but especially because they fought against it so hard and so vehemently, making comments about it being about race, which was false, misleading people about it being risky. And it wasn't about race. Indigenous peoples aren't a different race. We are a distinct people with a heritage and culture connected to this place, which deserves recognition. It was a simple message, just recognition through an advisory committee. We kept repeating that, but we just couldn't get through. We are a nation frozen in time, which isn't a good place for Indigenous people who in my father's lifetime, you know, he wasn't even counted as a citizen and his family needed permission to do just about anything in life under complete control of the state. So this isn't a good thing for our country, and I think we need to have a look at why this referendum failed when it was such a modest proposal, so important to the national interest.
Despite his disappointment, Thomas does see an upside in the fact that the campaign ran at all. The opportunity it gave campaigners to bring the plight of Australia's Indigenous peoples to the attention of the country's wider population.
The entrenched disadvantage of Indigenous people is not something that they normally think about. And it's one of the reasons why it was important we ran the referendum, though, because it did bring this to people's kitchen tables in their discussions for the first time. And on the positive side out of this referendum, 40% of Australians voted yes. That's 5.5 million Australians. We take that as a positive, that a lot of Australians learnt about us, a lot of Australians decided to walk with us, but it just wasn't enough to make the change that we hoped for.
And looking ahead, he's sure that change will eventually come about.
I'm certainly going to be continuing the campaign. It won't be for constitutional recognition. I think that might be done in my lifetime, but I do believe that our young people will do it because we see from the polling results that young people voted yes. Our children are getting a different education about the truth of our colonial past and the truth of why we have these disparities in the present. And so I think it'll eventually happen. My advice is continue to work hard, continue to fight for justice and never give up on that and believe in yourselves and your country.
So to come back to our question, what went wrong with Australia's Indigenous call for a voice? Well, in the end, it came down to political gravity. It's hard to win a referendum in Australia without bipartisan support. But at the very least, the debate brought the lives and dreams and demands of the country's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples to the attention of the whole nation. Very few Australians could now say that they were unaware of what Australia's First Nation peoples are holding out for. And that's not bad for a group that only makes up 4% of the country. This episode of The Inquiry was presented by me, David Baker, produced by Jill Collins, the researcher was Matt Toulson, and the editor was Tara McDermott.